So this is my first IDF meeting, and I see that you do not have enough mental health in the program overall, so I'll just start with that. I was given the topic, how to parent a child with a chronic illness. So how to parent a child, right there you've bought yourself a lifetime anxiety disorder. Okay, you're going to hear. So, and then on top of that, a child with a chronic illness, that's double the anxiety, and that's something that you're going to have to learn to work with. This is the NIH, as you've already heard, and I didn't have any financial disclosures to disclose, and you already heard the titillating, relevant disclosure that I'm Dr. Holland's wife.
We're sorry for you.
So obviously when you have a child, there's a lot of hope and dreams and thoughts that are going to be in your mind about what's coming forward. And for anyone who even has healthy children, those don't all come to bear. So it's a moment in your life where you have a lot of aspirations, but you know, you have to see what comes. Now, I trained initially as a pediatrician, and you heard Dr. Jenry say yesterday, our task in pediatric care is to maximize all children's functional abilities and sense of well-being, their health-related quality of life, and their development into healthy and productive adults. But I also trained as a psychiatrist and a child psychiatrist, and what we are concerned about is, you know, where's this line between what is normal and what is a disorder? And so all behaviors can be at one end or the other end of the spectrum. So if you sleep, everybody sleeps. But if you sleep too much, that could be a problem. Or if you eat, you know, that's a normal behavior, but at some point that could be a problem. We're all a little OCD. So, you know, physicians, hopefully your physician is a little bit obsessive compulsive and, you know, checks up on things. So you want that to some extent. But is it a disorder in which it's problematic for them and taking up too much time? So any behavior could become a problem or a disorder, but you just have to figure out the frequency and the duration and how much impairment is it causing. So that's what we think about. So a chronic illness can be viewed as a condition characterized by a set of challenges, serious challenges, that can either be overcome or lead to a sense of emotional defeat. And so I've spent my time trying to figure out and listening to thousands of parents like Vicki, what is it that parents find helps them overcome these challenges. And I have to say that I do a lot of consults with families who have rare disorders, and I'm not here to tell you all the things you're doing wrong. I'm really here to tell you that you're doing a lot of things right, and that I spend a lot of time telling parents, these are things that you're doing that are great, but maybe we could tweak some of these things to help you with some of the problems that are going on. So how big a problem is this? There are 74 million children under the age of 18 in the U.S., and approximately 20% of these children will have a chronic illness or special health care need. So that's a lot of children. And about 10% of children have a chronic condition that impacts their lives on a daily way. So have to take medicine, have to get chest PT, have to do some kind of therapy. So, and the good news is that, you know, at least 90% of these kids with chronic conditions are going to live into young adulthood. So because of our antibiotics, because of our surgery, we can take a 24-week-old baby and have them survive into adulthood. So there are a lot of things that we can do now, and that's where mental health actually comes into play, because in the beginning, people were just worried about their kids surviving. But the truth is, you know, if you're surviving and you don't have good mental health, what are you surviving, or quality of life, what are you surviving for? So it's really important to be doing this all medical management, but mental health management along the way. So approximately 10 to 20% of children in the general population have behavioral and emotional symptoms, and approximately double that with children with chronic conditions will have behavioral and emotional symptoms. So, and the problem is that a child's adjustment to their illness is not directly related to the severity of the medical condition. So we will see children who are hospitalized dozens and dozens of times, and they can still be sunny and, you know, want to go out, and whenever they get out of the hospital, they're ready to go do their paintings or whatever they're doing. And then we can also see the child who's been sick once, who's completely impaired and an invalid, doesn't go out, doesn't socialize. So we don't it's not a one-to-one correlation. And so we don't know exactly what predicts, but there are a few things. So age of onset of illness is an interesting one, because in some ways, it's harder for the older diagnosed person who was healthy, who was, you know, athletic and able to, you know, was running around mowing lawns before they got sick, and they don't see themselves as a sick person, as opposed to a child who grew up with it and they don't really know any differently. This is the way it's always been. They've always taken medicine. So adjustment doesn't necessarily isn't necessarily worse just because the child is younger at the time of diagnosis. So a person's intelligence. Obviously, there are a range of intelligences, both cognitive and emotional intelligence, and that can be variable. And the brighter you are, the better your problem solving. So higher IQ is better. And temperament, you know, if you're, so I saw a pair of twins once in the hospital, six-year-old twins, and one twin was really irritable and the other twin was really friendly. And of course, all the nurses just gravitated to the friendly twin, and the other twin was kind of left off to the side all the time. So your temperament can help you. It changes the environment around you. And social competence is very important. Now, what does the color coding mean? So I am always looking for the modifiable factor. What is something we can change or adapt or help? And so the question is, you know, can you modify intelligence? Maybe, you know, by providing a richer environment, trying good nutrition, trying not to do, you know, no lack of oxygen, that kind of thing. So taking care of things that, you know, can at least keep your intelligence. And then temperament might be something you can encourage. Social competence is something that you could help, you know, just like public speaking. Some people are not very comfortable with public speaking initially, but they can overcome that. They can learn how to be a better speaker. So social competence has some of that. You can learn to be more comfortable meeting with people, asking them to questions, asking for help. So, and that turns out to be a very key one, as you'll see. A person's previous experiences with illness will also color how they adapt. So I meet a lot of children who or families who've been told all kinds of strange things by doctors, you know, and it's easy to become mistrustful of the medical system because the doctors are wrong. They'll tell you, you know, your child's going to die in 2 weeks and here they are at 20. So it is hard to sometimes trust physicians and the medical system. So you do have these experiences that color how you're coming into a system. And it would be helpful for you to tell each time you're coming into a new system what were the experiences you had so that they can understand why you might be coming in a little more guarded about your problems. The nature and the severity of the illness. Clearly, if you do have brain-affected problems, those are more severe and can impair a child more. And also, sometimes having a physical disability can sometimes be more difficult. But I have to say that people who have illnesses where you can't see it, they will say to me, it's terrible. No, I wish I had, you know, some skin disease so that people would know what was wrong with me. I have CGD and nobody knows, they can't see it. And so they don't understand anything about me. So I wouldn't say necessarily the physical impairment itself is always a negative factor. Okay, and then the associated suffering or potential for reoccurrence. I work with a lot of children with cancer, so that's always hanging over their head. And even for patients who get recurrent infections, they're all sort of waiting for that next infection. So it's hard. And then what are the required treatment modalities? Does it require just taking a pill every day, or does it require chest PT 3 times a day? Do you have to worry about it before every meal? So how much is it encroaching on your daily life? And how much time does it take can also influence how well you adapt. Now, coping skills is something that we can teach, right? And there's passive coping and active coping. In general, the research supports that active coping, and you all are probably active copers since you're here trying to get more information and trying to learn what can you do. So that generally is helpful. There's always more things we can learn about coping. And I was impressed listening yesterday because so we're going to have bone marrow transplant, and it could be a cure, and three-year-olds may never even realize they had CGD as they're growing up, but that's going to present a whole set of different problems in their 20s and 30s that we're going to, I just felt like I'm never going to be out of business because there's going to be different challenges. They're going to be worried about fertility, and you know, why didn't we tell them about that when they were little? But, I mean, so there's always going to be new problems with technology. There's ethical things that come up, and there are always going to be psychosocial problems that are coming up. So where do you go for help for that? You should Vicki kind of pointed that out to you, but it's available, so you have to try to find it and use it. Family factors. So how the family copes is very critical, and the family's mental health, the parents' mental health, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But community factors, it's been shown that people who are religious or spiritual and have a community, but again, that's really talking about social support. So every study, no matter what, especially bone marrow transplant, but every study that I've looked at that shows chronic illness, people do better when they have more social support. So that's why I'm focused on getting you to teach your kids social competence, because being able to ask your nurse or being able to ask your doctor questions helps you and gets you more help. And your family relying, you can't do it all by yourself. So just, you need to not be able to ask for help. So I just want to key, what are the things that you're supposed to be thinking about in a development of a child? And the streams that the physicians are really good at are the motor development, fine motor development, physical growth. We have those charts that we all map other kids on, and everyone's very good at that. They're not as good at, they couldn't tell you, you know, you have to have 50 words by one, and you should be putting two words together by two. Maybe they know some of that, but there are a lot of language markers that are more refined, but not everybody knows those. And then cognitive development, people are grossly aware of it, but they really don't measure that very frequently. And then really, how many physicians do you know who are paying attention to whether your child is socially interacting? How are they attaching? If you're spending a lot of time in the hospital when your child is very young, attachment can be disrupted. So, and then emotional regulation and sexual development. That's another one that doctors don't talk too much about, but that's kind of key because, as you will see, there are adolescents that grow physically, but they're not emotionally ready, or I follow a lot of children with mental disabilities, and the body is going, you know, full force into puberty, but the brain is not anywhere near there. So that can be a real problem with the disconnect. So we do have to pay attention to sexual development as well. And a lot of patients are afraid to ask their doctors about it, and a lot of doctors are not interested in asking about it, especially pediatricians, because they're like, oh, that's the adult physician's problem. This is the psychosocial stages of Erickson, and these are kind of what are your tasks at different ages, and as infants, it's just to learn to trust. And then I see a lot of adolescents and young adults with medical illness, and really they're trying to figure out what are they going to do for jobs, what's their identity, are they going to be able to have relationships. These are all tasks that everybody goes through and that can be affected when you have a medical illness. So what is getting disrupted in kids with chronic illness? For you, if you can't see in the back, it says disciplining a child is simply too much work. We've decided to let society do it later. So. I'm going through the normal development steps that people worry about. And in infants, no matter what, genetics will play a role in disease and treatment response throughout life. So that's a given. And the environment, how it responds to it, is another given. So it's nature and nurture. It's not an either-or thing. So it's true that if once you have a baby who's diagnosed with a medical illness, your relationship to them is altered. So the problem is, and I sort of heard it in Vicki's talk, it's so hard to parent a sick kid because it's so hard to know, is this a serious cough or is this just a cough I can relax about? I mean, there's not too many coughs you can relax about in CGD, but every little thing is kind of like, do I take this headache? Do I start worrying about this? Or, you know, in healthy kids, you'd say, okay, go 2 weeks, the arm hurts, you know, it's probably a sprain, and then, you know, you feel bad, you take your kid to the ER, and then it turned out they broke it, you know. And so that every parent faces that, what to pay attention to and what not to pay attention to. But you really have something special to pay attention to. So it's very, very hard. But the key is that you have got to stay on those lines of development and try to keep your kid on that track of all those stages of psychosocial development, because that's what you're always trying to aim for. You might get derailed from it if there's a hospital stay, but then you want to try to get back on that track because that's the kids that do the best. And these are some of the things that do get affected when babies are small. And parents have told me, you know, that hospitalization when he was one just changed his temperament, and he was a really happy baby, and then you know, he got really irritable after that. And the steroids don't help necessarily. You know, I think you have to just go with it, but pay attention to what you can do when you're not in the hospital and try to help your child figure out the way to interact with other people. Parental mental illness can be very serious, especially when children are young, so it's very important to take care of yourself before you take care of your child and get things in order. And as you can see, there's some other things that can be just delayed or altered. It doesn't mean they're not happening, but they might be delayed or altered. Right. These are all. So children who are in school aged, the most important thing is developing peer interactions. So you don't want to isolate them, keep them away from other kids. It's hard. When I first started this, homeschooling was a very religious sort of isolative thing that only a few people did. I would say that homeschooling is, now they really have the curricula out there online, and that's better now. So I understand if your child is a child who gets recurrent infections and really probably shouldn't be around a lot of other kids, that homeschooling might be an alternative. But you have really got to find other ways for your child to meet other kids. That is really critical. Peer interaction is very important in that developmental window. And so you need to focus on that school. So school, I would say, the key to the childhood experiences is the routineness of it and the structure. And the truth is, kids, close your ears, kids need limits, okay? So they really need something to push against. That's going to be you. You can't be their best friend all the time. And, you know, that's the role of the parents. And basically, you know, Vicky said, so this is the thing. You're going to have to do things that make you feel guilty, that are hard. And every parent has to do that. But it's harder when you see your child in pain or suffering. And you just have to, you know, steel yourself for the fact that this is what you're doing and it's good for them. And that's part of the parenting role. And after they get through that round of whatever it is, they'll be better and you go back to the routine. But so you're always trying to get back to the routine as much as possible. It is really critical to help them develop self-esteem and mastery during that period. And I always counsel parents, find something your child's good at. It might not be outdoors, but it could be photography, it could be music, it could be computers. But find the thing that makes your child really excited and that they're good at and that turns them on. It takes a little while. It took us forever to find whatever. You know, you go through a lot of things like soccer and basketball, and you know, but then it turns out to be hockey, or you know, so you have to go through a few things, but you wish. it does happen. Now, I will say that kids in this period of age, the latency age kids, or middle school, elementary school, and some of middle school, are pretty good with their medicines because you're kind of guiding it, and they might actually remind you that they have to take their medicines. What Vicky said about adolescence is really true. That is a very hard time, and paradoxically, you actually probably could be less vigilant in that middle period, and you have to go back to being vigilant to adolescence. It's counterintuitive. You think, okay, they're adolescents. They're supposed to be more independent, but not about their medicines. So that would be my advice about it. So, you know, their identity is wrapped up in being sick. And I would say, I'm going to give another talk tomorrow, and I have my top 10 parenting rules. But I would say that don't let this illness define them. They have red hair. They have CGD. They have other things. But they have other skills, and they're people. And, you know, so that's really important. And you shouldn't let it define you as being that. So it's important to help them find who they are, but they're not their illness. And then they have a lot of physical and emotional changes. It's not unusual to find them to be a little bit delayed in that. And so this adolescent period is difficult because experimentation is normal. So there, you know, but you just heard, well, don't take alcohol when you do Bactrim. I mean, what adolescent do you know that doesn't want to try at least a little alcohol or other things? You're going to have to tolerate some of that. You cannot. I don't know how the other people feel about that, but there's going to be a little of that. The medicine you can try to supervise at that, but there's going to be stuff that happens behind closed doors. And you hope for that, actually. So if they're not doing that, then they're not on track. So in a way, it's a good sign, even though it's scary. And that's why you need to talk to other people to be like, is this okay? So they do have a need for non-adherence. So I followed this picture is actually from HIV. I used to work with a lot of young adolescents with HIV, and they really can't take their medicines one day and not take their medicines one day because they develop resistance to the drugs, and then there's no opportunity for them to stay on those drugs. So we actually sometimes took a drug holiday, but it was a discussion that we had as a group, you know, with the family, the patient, and the medical team. So sometimes you have to take that little break because it's part of their adolescence. So I'm just saying to you that you really do have to keep in mind these developmental and mental health needs that are going along, because as you heard this morning from Dr. Sullivan, the patients need to tell us what is going on, because the researchers have a view about things, and they think we all take our medicines perfectly 3 times a day, but there is not a single study that shows any patient makes it through the 10-day course of antibiotics 3 times a day. So the truth is that's not how we're actually doing it. So we need to hear from you all what is actually happening out there. So there is data that says, you know, that kids with chronic illnesses have elevated healthcare service use, more hospital days, poorer school attendance, lower academic achievement, less permanent employment, more likely to be single, and more likely to have delayed independence. So this is why, again, I'm in the red. What can we do to prevent these things? And this is what I'm always asking parents. How did you get your kid to go to college? Or how did you get your kid to get that job? I want to know. So things like groups like this, where parents share their ideas, camps where kids meet other kids who have what they have, and they realize that's not the only thing in the world. They have lives outside of their disease. That really helps other kids see that this is just a part of their life, but there's regular life to be had. So the other thing I would say is, what's the life curriculum? So skills that you need to deal with adversity in general. It's good to be able to focus your attention on a problem. It's good to be able to plan, monitor, and problem solve, delay gratification, be able to work with others. So that's the hidden curriculum. That is not the overt curriculum of school, but that is what is supposedly going on, you know, when you send your kids to school. All of these things are also going on. And I would just counsel you. So I have parents, again, with children with more disabilities, but don't be worried about if they're going to take calculus, or because it's more important if they can take a bus and they can read a bus route, or they can read the metro, or they can make change. You know, practical life is important, and it's not a curriculum, but people don't pay attention to that, and they get very focused on my child's not, you know, reading the 9th grade English curriculum. That curriculum might not be as helpful to you as taking, you know, a bus and figuring out how to go and run an errand by themselves. So you do have to sort of be able to let go, and that's hard for parents with chronic illness. Right, so you want to try to let them go to these special camps or have these little experiences away from you so they can slowly gain some independence, because ultimately you want them to be able to leave you, actually, hopefully. That's the goal. And executive function refers to mental flexibility, self-regulation, and practical life. That's what I was talking about. But self-regulation means being able to tolerate delay. So the guilt factor is tremendous for parents, and especially in the hospital. So when the kids go in the hospital, you see the parents go to the gift store, buy the bear. You know, they just feel terrible that the kid isn't. It's what Vicki said, though. Try to treat it more like everybody has to take pills. Just take your pill. You have to brush your teeth. You have to take your pills. It's not a fight every day. You just have to do these things. And try to treat it as part of their regular life. And hospitalizations are going to be part of their regular life. I have many, many patients tell me about their in-hospital life and their regular life. And sometimes they get sick because they just want to take a break from their regular life. And the parents are so nice to them in the hospital. They don't have any rules. They don't, you know, there's no, they get a free pass. They can sleep whatever they want. They can, you know, right? So parents have to be mindful that, because the guilt of being in the hospital is so intense. And you feel so sorry for your child, and why do we have to go through this? But really, the more businesslike you can be about it, like regular life, the better. the kids tell me on the fly, you know, yeah, you know, I know my mom's going to be like, not make me do anything about this. So in the hospital, everybody regresses. No matter who you are, you want to be babied, you want your comfort foods. So the pull to the parent to do that is intense. And you feel helpless. This is adults too. You're anxious, you're guilty, you want to deny there's any problems. Everybody gets a little depressed and their mood is labile. Frequently they have difficulty sleeping because the nurses are waking you up at 2 in the morning for your weight. The hospital is not designed for sleeping well, as anybody will tell you. And you might be irritable or defiant. And so my job in the hospital, and I'm a hospital psychiatrist, is to kind of determine, again, these are normal behaviors, but when is that behavior turning into a problem or a disorder? Is this depression? So, and again, it has to do with how much, how long, and how impairing, right? So if you're so all of these things that you're not doing anything the doctors are saying, I'm definitely going to get called. And then, of course, being in the hospital will aggravate any kind of psychiatric symptom you already have because it's an additional stress. Now, there is this phenomenon that was described in the 60s, and you still see today, really, but we don't talk about it too much, and it's called the vulnerable child syndrome. And it's what happens to parents when a life-threatening thing has happened to their child. They don't want to separate from the child because they're really afraid this child's going to die. And they baby them, and they make the baby over-dependent on them because they want to do everything for them. And I literally see parents feeding their 8-year-olds, you know, their breakfast. And you know, at 8, you can feed yourself breakfast. So they become very, so this is the danger, because you're going to be very preoccupied with every bodily statement your child makes. So how to kind of hang back a little bit and let them make it 2 or 3 times. Don't respond every time to the very first time they say it. Maybe if they say it 2 or 3 times in a day, like, I still have a headache, or okay, then, you know, but the first time, if you're going to respond to every little thing they say, they're going to know. They're going to know that that's going to happen, and they're going to say things, right? It's not intentional, but it's definitely an attentional thing that they figure out. Everybody likes attention. So, and the problem is that in the back of your head, you're anticipating some kind of failure. Like, they're not going to make it, and you really can't have that. You have to expect things from these children. This happened in the HIV world tremendously, because we all thought when we got those patients with HIV, they were all going to die by the time they were 5 anyway. So we pampered the whatever out of them and catered to them completely, and they had learned no rules. And let me tell you, trying to teach children rules at 13 is not simple. It doesn't happen. You need to be starting them at 2, right? So then we had a bunch of 13-year-olds who had never had any rules and just were miserable because nobody thought they were going to survive. But you just have to assume your child's going to survive, and you have to assume they're going to be an adult and healthy, and you have to try to do all the things that you would normally do to make them a healthy, independent adult. So it's very understandable that parents would have this kind of anxiety, but talk about it. Talk about what you're worried about with somebody. It's been duly noted that generally you don't want to bring up those things with your physician because you think that's not something they want to be worried about, or that's taking up too much of their precious time. But then find someone else on the team. Talk to a Vicky, or talk to, there should be a psychologist on your team, but find somebody to talk to about it, because these can really be more important in some ways. And so this was called vulnerable child syndrome, but I think it might be more aptly called vulnerable parent syndrome. So why am I focused on this? Because guess what? Your child's coping skills come from you. How you cope is how they're going to cope. So your ability to cope is really, really important, and that's why I'm so focused on this. It's definitely been shown parents who cope successfully with their child's illness can isolate their fears and anxieties, just what Vicky said. Go out of the room before you, like, start crying about it. Then you can help your child better, and you're trying to get your child to self-care and independence. Parent treatments for anxiety, all these things are the things your grandma told you to do. get, you know, eat well, sleep well, exercise, avoid alcohol. But there are other treatments. They have shown group therapies help parents. Just talking about it helps parents. There are different kinds of cognitive behavioral structures that can help parents. So, and they can definitely show that they reduce anxiety in children when they reduce anxiety in parents. All right, so what else does a psychiatrist get called for in the hospital? We get called for behavioral problems where they won't take their medicine, non-adherence. We get called for pain management. And there are a lot of techniques your child can learn. And there are a lot of people around the hospital, child life therapists, recreation therapists, who can help your child learn these things. And just because your child learned something when they were 8 doesn't mean they don't need to relearn it when they're 10. So you tell your child they have CDD at 8, they have a very minimal understanding that they have some cells that don't work, and they got to take some medicine for that. You need to have that discussion again with them when they're 11 or 12. What does that mean? What do they understand about it? What, you know, question and check with them what their ideas about it are, because it changes and they can contain more information as they get older, and they might be stuck with really primitive ideas about it if you don't go in there and check every once in a while, well, where are they with all of this? So it's important for you to think about checking in periodically again about the diagnosis. So there's a lot of examples in the psychiatric literature or psychology literature. The patient says, they told me there's a demon in my belly. Okay. What the doctor said was there's edema in your belly or swelling, right? But the kid heard there's a demon in my belly. So this is why you have to check, what did the kid hear from these appointments? I'm a little worried about all the things everybody's hearing today. So you should go back and, you know, check with people about what did you hear? Was that right? Is that, you know, what does it really mean for me? Because not all of these things apply to everyone. So, okay. So lots of techniques to learn, deep breathing, relaxation, distraction. Everybody knows how distraction works terrifically. We can teach kids guided imagery, hypnosis. A lot of kids can self-hypnotize, it works. Heat, cold, you know, she talked about the ice cube for the shot, so that's the cold. So there's a pain theory that if you have something else going on, you can't be totally focused on the nerves that are having the pain. So now there's even this little thing, we haven't tested it yet, but there's a little bee sting kind of device that you can put on that supposedly causes vibrations around where the shot is happening, and maybe that decreases shot. So we're always looking for ways to decrease pain. And I would say that's really important because the less pain, the less trauma overall. There are behavioral methods, which Vicki alluded to in terms of behavioral methods, and some of those, you know, some of the staff around the hospital can teach you. Otherwise, you can get additional help from behavioral therapists. Cognitive behavioral therapy is very targeted therapy. This is not lying on your couch and being in therapy forever. You have a problem, go ask for help for the problem. Work on it for 6 weeks, and then, you know, that problem can be addressed. So therapies can be used in the mental health realm in the same way that you use therapies in the physical realm. And these are just some of the things that can be used for. Sometimes medication can be useful if there are persistent states of being sad or just such severe anxiety you can't leave the house or you're having panic attacks. There are roles for medication even in children. And these are just, you know, a list of the medications that we have tried in children that are reported in the literature. Obviously, you have to check with the primary team because there are interactions between things like itraconazole and posaconazole. But you really do want to know that this is still a tool that's there in the toolbox as well. Now, when should you actually get a psychiatrist involved? Now, this is, again, sort of the theme of the meeting. There are specialists for everything, and there are specialists who are psychiatrists for the medically and surgically ill and the chronically ill. So that's called psychosomatic medicine. It's a very unwieldy name, but so I'm a pediatric psychosomatic medicine psychiatrist or consult liaison psychiatrist. Every children's hospital has one of these, at least, and so that's the psychiatrist level of it. There's health psychologists who are all health. They only study the psychology of working with chronically ill kids and adults. So when you're looking for help, you want to look for those specialty areas because they're used to working with people who have complex medical conditions and are on other medications, and so they're used to the same kinds of problems. So when I get called, it's either to figure out, is this behavior because, you know, is this person depressed because they're getting interferon? Because sometimes interferon can cause depression. Are they depressed because they have CGD, and sometimes that can run with, or not so much CGD, but like pancreatic cancer, for instance. People get depressed before they show up with the cancer. So sometimes that's actually a sign of the cancer coming. So it could be a primary part of the disease. Does the person already have a psychiatric disorder? Maybe they came to the hospital and they already have ADHD, and it's really hard for them to stand around in the hospital and do things. So, you know, sometimes they want to help get a management plan. Or is this the psychological reaction to being sick? And so we try to help distinguish. And again, you heard it was because of kind of the whole constellation. Does the family history there? Is it how and how long has it been present? So just this is an example. You could put is anxiety / depression transient or persistent? Is it getting in the way of care, treatment, or recovery? Is the person not responding to the situation because they're so isolated and withdrawn from it? And they just are completely anxious all the time without, despite all these other attempts to do these other things. So why does that happen? So I do have a theory that children with chronic illness are a little more susceptible to some of these anxiety and depressions as they get older, not initially. But, you know, stress and any kind of adversity does play on your hormones, and this is a feedback loop, and they do interact with inflammatory markers, and they do cause depression and anxiety. And if you think about it this way, you have a problem, you get a stress, your cortisol goes up, and then it comes back down. But in your life, sometimes you have so many stresses, it just keeps coming, right? You know, you take your antibiotics, and it doesn't work, you're back in the hospital, and you stop adapting, and you either end up stuck just secreting cortisol all the time, in which case you're in a hypercortisol state, or it's broken, it can't secrete anymore, it's depleted, and so you end up in a low cortisol state. So this is the time, I think, some kids with repeated stresses might need some medicine to help kickstart some of these things back into order. I do research on screening kids in emergency departments for suicide. And I just say that physical illness and chronic pain is a risk factor. And that these are all the things that, remember, we're focused on the protective factors, right? So close family relationships, meaningful school, strong friendships, cultural and religious beliefs. So there are many protective factors that you want to try to work on. And suicide is very rare in this population, but you have to ask. You can't assume that that's not some thought that has crossed somebody's mind. So you will be hearing people ask more in the hospital as they do admissions, because that's sort of a general movement. And it's complicated in the medical. So we initially made the screen in the psychiatric emergency room for kids with behavioral problems and psychiatric problems. But in the medical hospital, we're finding it very challenging because, and you just have to ask directly, are you having thoughts about killing yourself? Because these kids all do have thoughts about dying at some point or another. So that's not the same thing as thinking about killing yourself. So if the physician is not very careful, they're like, not asking it right, it comes out in a different way. So you just want to be real specific about what you're asking about. All right, so we do help parents try to figure out if they're having any issues and how we can help them be the best parent they can be. We do also want them to understand that they have to have expectations and not overindulge their kids. And we do want them to have parents reflect on their parenting style and work on communication in the family. So I'm going to just touch a little bit on this. The parents are not the only ones that need help in this. We do need to think about how we do medicine in general. And, you know, you heard a lot about patient-centered, and many places claim to be patient-centered. But the truth is there's some things that we do a lot of procedures that maybe we don't have to do. Now, if you come to research, you're going to be doing a lot of extra procedures, and you have to think about that, you know, and we try to mitigate the pain, especially when we're doing research, because it's an added thing. But does your physician have to draw blood every single day? do they really, you know, I just, you know, you have to think about this, and I'm going to make, you know, you all a bunch of pain in the neck patients, but I just, from the child's perspective, I'm saying that that's not necessarily always the best thing, and you really want to question, are you getting everything you need to get out of this? Does it have to be every day? Can it be every other day? Does it? What is it really telling you? So just to be, you're always going to be your child's advocate now. So we tried to work on making the hospital more ouchless. And we also, one of the things that was really lost in the current healthcare system, back in the day when I trained, teams all met quite frequently, you know. Hi. The psychologists and the mental health, the medical teams all met together, the rehab, the everybody, and we don't have that anymore because it's not paid for. So we really, you need to push for your doctors to talk to each other. and then we are spending more time just making sure the hospitals are paying more attention to mental health issues. So I spend a lot of time trying to make sure physicians understand that their medical decisions actually impact on children's development. We want to create active partnerships with you, have clear expectations for chronically ill children, and enforce all the cooperation. And we really want to try to minimize post-traumatic stress where possible, because a significant portion of patients who spend a lot of time in the hospital actually do have post-traumatic stress symptoms. So we want to avoid that. The other thing is, and you've already heard all this, people are encouraging support groups, telephone visits. It's harder with the infections, you know, group that went away for a little while because hospital infections were such a problem. But now that we have the internet and a lot of chat rooms, I think it's really gotten better again. But just, you know, have people develop their talents. They don't always have to be academic. And I already mentioned maintaining behaviors. All right. So how many people are over 21 that are patients here? Okay. And were there any issues in transitioning care to adult care? Not really. So one of the things that we're quite concerned about is that transitioning to adult care from pediatric care is a multifaceted process and really takes some time, at least in our experience in HIV. It wasn't not like you could just hand them over. And we lost a few patients because of the transfer, because the patients were used to, in the pediatric world, the nurse calls you all the time, are you taking your medicine? You know, the adult folks are not going to do that. The adult folks put all the responsibility on you. And it's not about talking to your family. It's not, there's not all these other services around. If you don't want to take the treatment, that's fine. You're an adult. They accept that, whereas we would not accept that in the pediatric world. There's not as much supervision of the trainees. So it's a very different world once you transition to the adult world, which is why when Dr. Holland said, you need to be teaching your kids their medicines when they're 7, 8, 9, you know, above, the name of the disorder, yeah.
In my case, I was diagnosed when I was 7, and I was always taught that you are your own advocate, you know, you say your parents are your advocate. I was really taught that I was responsible for myself, not the doctor, not my mom. And even as a young adult, there were many times that I would go to the hospital by myself. My mother didn't go with me, but, you know, if I was going to surgery,
so the electronic patient health record will be very helpful. We make little medical passports for kids and say that you really need to have your medical record all the time, because if your parent's not there to tell the story, who's telling the story? Or you go to an ER for some reason, who's telling the story? And there are examples on there's a great website, gottransition.org, and they have, you know, the three-sentence story that you would give if you actually had to walk into an ER. In terms of what your diagnosis is, what meds you're on, and why did you come to the ER today? Can you actually articulate the problem and say it? So I think there are some resources out there now. Now, just to say, I cover the whole span of what might happen in CGD, and this is my example from oncology. So currently I mostly work with pediatric oncology patients, but this is like the patient PCORI that you heard about this morning, and we've been doing patient-centered care all along. We talk to the patients. It comes from the clinical service, and we find out what it is they want. What materials do they want? Just like the book that got created, we also have created many books and games for chronic illness that you can play with your kids called Shop Talk. And we have one version for chronically medically ill kids. And we work with them, and we develop tools for them. And so, and this, you can set up a research shop in any center with a social worker, a psychologist, and a psychiatrist. It doesn't take a lot of resources, but you have to have some people that are interested in your center. This is a mandala. This is artwork that a child made who had cancer. And, you know, when will there be a cure? When am I going to get sick again? What will happen to me? What will it feel like to no longer exist? When will I die? When will I live long enough to go to college, school, or get married? So that, you know, when we talk to the kids, these are the things they worry about. You might not know because they don't want to tell you they're worrying about this because they don't want you to be worried about them. And you don't want to tell them you're worried about this because you don't want to worry them more. So everybody's worried, but nobody can talk to each other about all these things. So fine, find the third person. Find a neutral person who isn't going to be all upset if they hear these things. I mean, so these are what come from kids. We talk to kids directly. We think that's really important. And in this case, we did make a document. So we were doing advanced care planning. There was no such thing for young adolescents and young adults with cancer. So there is this document out there that we made that has been downloaded quite a few times. All right, so we're going to summarize. What do parents want help with? They want to be assisted in the loss of normalcy on an ongoing basis. They don't necessarily want it to be from their main care provider, but they do want that from the team. There really should be regular psychosocial evaluations in your clinic visits at some regularity. And you need counselors who are trained in chronic illness issues, that you need help with navigating school and home, and how to develop coping skills. And then I'm interested in modifying the hospital environment, because I think we have to pay attention to how physicians give bad news and what the patient heard. And that's always important to check back. We need to be sensitive to the impact of medical illness on development, and we want to structure and try to be more routine in the hospital. We don't tend to do that. And I have to say, nursing, you know, is very good at attending to the patient's needs, but it's way easier for a nurse to attend to if you say, I have a headache. Then they prop your pillows up and they give you a pill, and then you start crying. And they're like, can I get you that pill, honey? And they leave the room because it makes nurses uncomfortable when patients are crying. So we need to get better at handling patient distress as it is. And we also need to treat pain and distinguish between physical pain and emotional pain. All right. And lastly, you know, we really want to get mental health more integrated and provide more research on what might be actually part of the disease and what might not be. So we had some indication that maybe there are some learning issues in CGD. Maybe there are, so, and there's definitely some immune deficiencies that go to the brain. So we need to study those more closely in the future. All right, I wish I had the magic wand to fix all these problems, but we are not here yet, but we will get there. Thanks very much.